right, welcome to another podcast edition of the True Crime Podcaster. I am the host, Ryan Horn, and always glad to have you here, always glad to be here with you. And we are able to be here with you because we have good sponsors like The Weekend Angler. And check out his YouTube channel, The Weekend Angler, and learn all kinds of cool fishing tips and see how they help make this podcast possible to tell you stories of true crime and educate you on the criminal justice system. Well, speaking of education, the story we're going to feature in this episode was someone who reached a decent educational level and certainly was not one that you would normally suspect to commit a gruesome crime, like you will find out and like you'll hear about in this episode. And the name Melanie McGuire may not necessarily ring a lot of bells, but some of you, again, that are Gen X and older, might remember about 20 years ago a case that the news media famously dubbed the nurse behind the suitcase murder. And Melanie McGuire was a nurse who was discovered later to have committed a gruesome murder of her husband back in 2004. Now, she's certainly not the first spouse or healthcare worker or anything like that to commit a murder or murder their spouse or anything like that. Normally, we probably wouldn't even have a lot of information on this case. It'd probably be something that would be mainly tied to the local area where it happened, and that's it. But in this case, since the media was very fascinated with some of the details, which you'll see in a bit, and you'll hear in a bit how the suitcase came into play in this case, but it was something that fascinated the media and gave this case a lot of attention and a lot of coverage that it may not have gotten otherwise. So why was a suitcase involved in a murder? Well, as you can imagine, it had something to do with the concealment, and we'll see in a little bit just how that came into play. But it's not, as you'll see, the body of her husband that she murdered was not discovered in a usual way that you would expect to, at least not in a location or jurisdiction you would in any case, really. But a little, just quick background on Mrs. McGuire. She was born in 1972, so really she's a Gen Xer like myself, and for those of you that are fellow Gen Xers. And she grew up in the state of New Jersey. And as I said about education just a little bit ago, she pretty much excelled in academics in school and college and went on to earn her nursing degree, which I've had friends that have done that, and I understand it's certainly not an easy accomplishment to graduate through nursing school. Wife is a physical therapist, and I've got a cousin that recently, a year or two ago, became a physician's assistant. So I know the level of intelligence that goes into earning a degree in these fields, it's not easy. So, you know, she had to have a certain level of intelligence to get this far. And she ends up marrying in 1999 to a former Navy vet, Bill McGuire. So, as usual, when we talk about in these cases, nothing unusual is happening at this point. She grows up, does well in school, gets a nursing degree, marries an ex-military guy who was working as a computer programmer, the way I understand it. So, pretty much normal middle-class, middle-America life at this point, right? But also, as usual, not everything as it seems. And not everything's normal behind the scenes, as we many times or always will see in these types of cases. So, what would motivate somebody who's living a pretty normal life, it seems, middle class, middle America life, as I said, both of them successful. She's a nurse. He's a computer programmer. He's served his country as a veteran in the armed services. So what would motivate somebody to commit a murder? Well, as you're going to see, it is one of the common motives what she had, but there's also a common motive we see in a lot of these cases that really, in my opinion, was kind of surprisingly missing in this case. So they also had two sons prior to his murder, and They were wanting to move into a larger home, which, again, that's normal. Sometimes you have to expand and get a bigger home as your family expands. And they had two children, and they want to get a bigger house. So at this point, again, everything so far seems completely normal. But as we far too many times see, that doesn't always... things aren't always what they seem on the surface. And even though they did apparently actually close on a new home, they did not ever move into that home. Why, you ask? Well, before that could be done, Bill's body was found dead on May the 5th, 2004. So they've closed on the house that they need to a bigger home, grow their family, things like that. But before they can even do that, Bill's body is found dead and murdered. But how was he found dead? As I said at the beginning of the episode, this was not the case of, or it's not a common case where it's just how bodies are often found in these types of cases. Usually in a murder case, they're not found in the strange manner that you'll hear about in a second, how Bill's body was found. Because his remains were found in a suitcase, which you figure that much, right? You've heard at the beginning of the podcast, this is the suitcase murders. He's found floating in a suitcase, parts of his body, in the Chesapeake Bay area in Virginia. Now, you probably say, wait a minute, this started out in Virginia. That's where the case takes a little bit of an interesting turn, because he's traveled quite a bit from where he lives and resided to where his body's found. New Jersey is a pretty good little haul from Virginia, and that immediately gives this case kind of a strange element or turn to it. Now, police notified of this body, and they find in this suitcase it contains his head and torso, one bullet wound to the head and two to the chest. Now, a smaller suitcase containing his arms was found in that area, but on May 16th. So, you probably are also asking then, how are authorities in Virginia going to be able to tie a possible murder case all the way into the state of New Jersey? Well, they got a bit of a break, which is oftentimes how cases turn like this. It's not always the brilliant CSI type of forensic work you see on movies and TV. Most of the time, the overwhelming majority of the time, cases are solved by just blind luck or anonymous tips and things of that sort. And it wasn't an anonymous tip, but you can certainly say it probably was just a bit of blind luck, because police released a facial reconstruction sketch of Bill McGuire, who happened to be recognized by somebody who knew him. Now, at this time, I'm guessing this is 2004, this is 20 years ago, we heavily had to rely on this time on TV news primarily. And we had the internet, but it wasn't quite as dominant of a force in our lives as it is now. And one of the key things we didn't really have going at that time like we do now is social media. This is, again, 2004. Facebook is on the campus of Harvard at this time, and it's just becoming a thing at all. They're just developing it, starting out as a campus thing, and we know where it's evolved to now. But in 2004, this was not a nationwide thing, and we didn't have really social media going at that time. I don't remember at that time if MySpace was out or not. Never actually owned a MySpace account. Didn't get on board later till Facebook and some of the others came around, but if it was around then, again, it wasn't a dominant force. So at this time, people are still relying on television news and newspapers and maybe some internet news and things like that. But information didn't travel quite as quickly then as it does now. So they really got lucky in the fact that somebody, wherever this gentleman saw the sketch at, was able to recognize Mr. McGuire and give the police some valuable tips and information. And as usual, when they find a dead spouse or find somebody dead and they find out they're married, the spouse is going to, at least initially, be a suspect. It's just common protocol. It doesn't mean that everybody who gets killed is murdered by their spouse, but it is a very common thing a lot of times, and that is where law enforcement often start before they work their way out and eliminate and find other suspects. So Since they figure this happened in New Jersey, the New Jersey State Police assumed control of the investigation. Now, they quickly discovered on April 26, 2024, Mrs. McGuire had purchased a .38 caliber handgun. Not normally would be that big a deal, right? But that is the same caliber that killed Bill. Now, this is at this point, again, mostly what you would say probably could be circumstantial evidence. And here's the thing to keep in mind. This is something I tell my college classes that I teach. Circumstantial evidence can be admissible in court. Don't go by the BS on TV and movies where, you know, you'll see the defense attorney, this is circumstantial evidence, this can't go, and blah, blah, blah. And you'd be surprised how many people think circumstantial evidence is not admissible in American courts. Well, it is. I will say it's not advisable, and it's certainly not recommended that you build your case on it. You certainly want more direct evidence if you're going to build a case, but sometimes all you get in a case that you can get evidence-wise is circumstantial evidence, and it's all you have to go on, and you have to work with what you have. But a key thing to keep in mind, even if they don't get any more evidence, they can try a case on circumstantial evidence. It's your chances of winning are not as good, of course, but sometimes, as I said, that's the only chance you get. But at this point, things are certainly looking very suspicious with Miss McGuire. She happened to, very quickly before her husband died, happened to purchase the same caliber handgun that was used in his killing. Now, they were also informed by a tow company employee that he had actually recently towed Bill's vehicle from a motel in Atlantic City. Now, big shock here, the security footage on the camera was too grainy to identify her personally, and she would later claim that this was, quote, just a prank. But days earlier, she had sought an order of protection against him, or what some of you in other jurisdictions might call a restraining order. Now, everybody knows it's just a piece of paper. It certainly isn't foolproof to stop anything. But if she was supposedly in fear of Mr. McGuire so much that she took one of these out on him, why would she in turn be pulling a quote-unquote prank at him at an Atlantic City hotel? You probably find that suspicious, and I assure you so did the police in this case. It certainly didn't make sense. And you have to wonder how scared somebody is of someone. Why, again, why would they take out an order of protection on them and then later be still involved in contact with them, pulling pranks, taking their cars, this and that? Doesn't add up, and to police it didn't add up. Now, they also discovered in their investigation that she was having an affair with a coworker, and they were able to trace her travel from a toll booth in Delaware. And what would later turn out to be a key piece of evidence was just a 90-cent charge that she tried to have removed from this account. Now, obviously, she probably thought back later this would provide a paper trail on her travels. Now, her excuse was, that she, and she claimed that she was only going to Delaware to shop because there's no sales tax in Delaware. And I guess geographically, that's close enough by. I'm sure a lot of people probably in New Jersey may once in a while travel to Delaware for shopping or whatever. It's not that unusual itself, but it provided a travel timeline. And again, one of the key things they were able to nail her on was a 90-cent toll charge. But police were also puzzled and very much aroused with interest when they found out that she tried to have that taken off. Why would you care if a 90-cent toll charge is on your record of your account anywhere? That certainly not something most people would want off their record. It's not that big a deal. But suspiciously, she wanted that scrubbed from her account, and this gave police even more suspicion. So you have her husband discovered dead. She recently, right before he turns up dead, has bought the same caliber of handgun he was killed with. She's having an affair with her coworker. She's seen moving his vehicle in a very suspicious time and area around his murder. And they've got a paper trail of her traveling around this time, because again, remember, his body's found in Virginia. So she's traveling south there through Delaware and everywhere else to get on the way to Virginia. So a lot of things are suddenly adding up and starting to very much more so point evidence that she was involved in his murder. Now, what a forensic investigation would later determine, though, is that she likely obtained a strong sedative at work and injected him to incapacitate him. Now, forensics also showed she used a pillow or a cushion as a silencer. So again, forensic evidence is certainly pointing the fingers on top of the circumstantial evidence we have. So now it's very much looking clear, like we have a clear-cut case to nail her and charge her with her husband's murder. Again, very thankful that this evidence exists, or this type of technology exists where we can gather this type of evidence, because generations ago it certainly wasn't possible, and there's a good chance she might have gotten away with murder. So something to check out is learn about all the sometimes the technologies and how much this has changed the criminal justice field. And it really only started about 100 years ago, I think, roughly, when they really started doing fingerprints and other types of evidence. Prior to this, there was very little scientific evidence involved in policing. But in the last century or so, it's very much rapidly changed and has enabled a lot of people like this to be brought to justice that otherwise would not have been brought to justice. So she has the means. She has she has the means and the opportunity. All we have left that we really need is a motive, because, you know, when you get together a crime, those are the big three elements you really want to be able to prove. Did they have the means, motive, and opportunity to do it? Well, she certainly had the means. She's bought the gun. That certainly gave her the capability to do it. She certainly had the opportunity, because that's her husband, and he was still around her, even though there was an order of protection against him at the time. She likely still was in some semblance of contact with him at that point. So now we have to discover, what was a motive? Well, normally I would have to think, you're going to have to look at, was there a recent life insurance policy taken out? That's usually one of the real smoking guns in these type of cases, and really helps you tie down a motive. The other often the times, though, we see is there is another person involved in it, so they can get that spouse out of the way and be with their lover. Well, we did find out a little bit ago, police did determine in their investigation that she was involved in an affair with a co-worker. And, you know, a lot of times it's just what simply the motives are. I remember Lieutenant Kendo, I don't know if his show's still on the ID channel or not, but when it was on, I remember he said pretty much, you know, money and revenge and sex, those are the big three motives a lot of times why people kill. Well, I don't think revenge is involved in anything, because there's no evidence that Bill McGuire ever did anything to harm his spouse. Money did not oddly seem to be a motive. If it was, I've seen very little evidence or anything ever really mentioned in the records that we have of this case that she committed this murder. If it wasn't for any type of life insurance policy, they weren't, drowning in debt or anything like that, as we often see, or she didn't kill him just because she was greedy and wanted to get the money. No, appears one of the other big motives played a role in this, and it was sex and an affair that she was involved in outside her marriage. So they've got all three elements to complete it. They got the means, motive, and opportunity. And with that, they go forward and they do make the arrest of her on June the 2nd, 2005, for her husband's murder. This is over a year after his body was found. Now, she was able to make bail prior to the trial. Now, she's out at this point, but she would actually face additional charges, including obstructing justice, probably trying to tamper and hide the evidence, maybe some things that she said where she lied to investigators. But she faces that, and as we'll see in a little bit, some other lesser charges outside of the first-degree murder charge. So she's arrested, but as we often see, and I can tell you this from my times at the sheriff's office, especially on murder cases, they sat there the longest. She doesn't go to trial until almost 3 years later, and that's not uncommon. I saw a lot of murder cases where people sat in jail for 3 or 4 years before they ever actually went to trial. You can sit in a county jail, actually be sentenced to a county jail, at a maximum of 1 year that you can be sentenced, but you can sit in jail for years and years awaiting trial because you're not sentenced there. So She was actually charged or went to trial 3 years later. Now, she's not in jail at this point that I'm aware of because she had posted bond. I'm not sure. It's not said whether she was arrested or not on any of these additional charges, but she did face them. Now, 3 years later, on April 23rd, 2007, she was found guilty of murder. So we're talking almost 3 years to the day her husband was found dead. She was finally brought to justice and found guilty, and she was also found guilty of perjury, which, you know, lying on the stand, witness stand, and of some of the other lesser charges, the obstructing charges and, you know, a handful of other smaller charges. Could be prosecutors filed those as kind of an ace in the hole. In case they couldn't get her on the first degree murder, they might be able to get her on some of these other things. But fortunately for the prosecutors in this case, they were able to convict her of the first degree murder charge. As I said, this likely wouldn't be that unusual of a case if not for the media sensationalism about the suitcase, which does demonstrate the power of the media. Now, I don't know, 20 years later, if social media and Facebook would have made this more popular or not, because people don't pay as much attention to broadcast news as they did back then, and they were able to, you know, sensationalize this case because of the suitcase element of it. It's hard to say. I don't know. I could see it going either way. Maybe social media and the internet now would make this a big deal just as it was 20 years ago, or who knows, maybe it wouldn't be that big a deal now, because now we know about things like this that happen everywhere. 20 years ago, it was rare for, say, folks like me in Illinois to hear about cases like this in New Jersey. If it didn't happen in our news, local news broadcast, or we didn't read about it in the newspapers when we still read newspapers, we didn't really know about it that much. So as going back to that technology thing, that's how much technology has changed criminal justice in so many ways, even about public knowledge about cases. It's drastically changed it. So in 2014, she does appeal this claim, or appeals her sentence on the claim of inadequate counsel. Now, her appeal was denied. She will not be eligible for parole until she is 101 years old, which is 2073. Apparently, there was a Lifetime movie made about this case called The Suitcase Killer. You can check that out. I don't know if it streams or anything, but if you're a watcher of that network or if you stream it, you might be able to find something on it on there. But this is a case that certainly got a lot of attention because of the media. And it is a little unusual because, like I said, most of the time in these type of situations where, especially when the wife kills the husband, usually it's a life insurance or something like that involved, or revenge, maybe found out he was having an affair or something. But it just appears she wanted him out of the way to be with her lover. So who knows, but that appears to be what the motivation was in this case. But we're glad you're motivated to keep tuning in and hanging out with us each week. Now, we are not going to be here next week, going to be doing some Lions Club activities and some presentations, some of the scholarships we give out to local people in the community, and would highly encourage you to join your local Lions Club. Very good charitable organization, good folks to be involved with. As I always say too, adopt from your local pet shelter. Find your next best friend for life there, you can. And we're just glad you tune in here each week. Check out my website for if you're in need of voiceover work. Please contact me. Be glad to voice your next audio book or project, ryan-horn.com. Check out some of the books I've done, such as the Howard Hawks book on Cherry Hills Publishing or In Danger of Judgment with Beacon Audio Books. And please follow our Facebook page and check out our new website, truecrimepodcaster.com, and all kinds of knowledge and updates on future episodes, because we'll be back in a couple weeks. We are going to be off this next week, but please be back and join us as soon as you can. Please watch out for your friends and family. Dangerous world out there, folks, so please be safe. God bless. Take care, everybody. I'll see you next time.